You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, CBD oil is big news lately, but what is it and what do we know about how it works? A science writer tells us about the latest research on the hemp-derived product and some unanswered questions.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Governor-elect Tony Evers is traveling the state on a listening tour to get feedback for his upcoming state budget. The city of Baraboo continues to deal with the attention that came after a viral photo of high school students giving a Nazi salute. And a Wisconsin YMCA is banning cable news from its TVs.
Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Why, thank you for having me.
All right, we've got Governor-elect Tony Evers and incoming Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes holding budget listening sessions around the state. They started in Green Bay and Wausau. And here's a listen to Evers speaking after the event in Green Bay.
And so we decided early on after the election to make sure that we were reaching out to people and asking them. And as I said, the difference between this type of input and what we had a week or so ago in the Capitol was just stark.
So Evers there comparing and contrasting these listening sessions and the lame duck session of the state legislature. What's happening at these budget events, Rob?
Sure. Well, so these are local events. They've been in Green Bay and Wausau this week, and he's going to be going to La Crosse and Milwaukee next week. And they're sort of set up like seems like what a teacher might set up a retreat or whatever. So the people it's open to the public. People come, then they break into small groups and talk about the topic at hand, talk about their own, you know, sort of priorities for schools or criminal justice or whatever, and governor-elect and lieutenant governor-elect sort of wander and listen in and take part in the conversation.
And Evers says the input at these sessions is going to help shape his state budget proposal. We know some of the big campaign issues he talked about. Do we know what kind of things he might focus on in the budget next month?
So he had talked about tax relief, sort of a middle class tax cut, as part one of his budget priorities. That the idea was to pay for that by slashing some manufacturing or agriculture tax credits that Wisconsin does. He has an education background. I think money for schools is politically popular, and that is very likely to be a priority in his budget. But you know, it's hard to say. And like, you know, the thing to always understand is like the governor's proposed budget is an opening bid in a very long negotiation.
Right.
And especially so next year.
Yeah, with divided government, we often see late budgets. They get a tardy, I guess, continuing the teacher metaphor. That's something, this could be a contentious budget season with a Democratic governor, Republican legislature.
Right, and so I don't want to, like, you know, minimize the input that Evers and Barnes are receiving from these public events. I think they're, you know, people who attended say they felt like they were listened to and they were like excited to be able to share their views and priorities. But like, this is also laying groundwork for big political fights to come. And you heard it in the clip that you played. You know, Evers has a political interest in contrasting his approach to the approach taken by Republicans in the legislature in their lame duck session, which was very closed. I mean, that was not an open sort of public facing session. And so this is, I mean, you know, one of the things that Evers is up to here is to try to lay out that is, you know, he has a different approach.
Let's move on to another issue we've been following, Rob. This is the spread of this photo from Baraboo High School showing male students giving an apparent Nazi salute before prom. The city's got a lot of attention, and the latest now apparently from some anti-Semitic groups and internet users. What's the latest there?
Right. So when this sort of blew up and became a viral phenomenon, the district made the decision not to discipline these students who were shown in the photograph giving the Nazi salute. But what they did say they would do is hold some public events, educational events aimed at the students. And one of the things they're doing is what the district is calling a day of peace assemblies next Tuesday that are meant to promote tolerance and understanding. So ahead of that event, somebody posted some gross anti-Semitic flyers and created an online video. It is an incident that got a lot of people's attention and traveled around the world very quickly. And among those whose attention it got are the white supremacists, the Nazi groups, who now are wanting to insert themselves into the process more and try to prevent, just discourage people or sow discord ahead of the district's planned response.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at top stories from around the state this week. Rob, here's an interesting one. The YMCA in Stevens Point, you can go there, you can exercise. They got a gym there. They are banning cable news stations from the TVs in their building. What's going on there?
No CNN, no Fox, no MSNBC at the YMCA. Not allowed. Let's to be precise here, it's banned from the main TVs, like the big TVs that are up on the wall. You can still watch your talking heads on like small screen on your elliptical machine or on your phone or whatever. It's in response to a specific event, they say. There was an actual altercation. Somebody was mad. The YMCA owner or director claimed in the news story that he did not remember what channel was at issue. I don't buy it. I think he just isn't saying. But anyway, somebody got really mad at why are you watching this garbage? And I sort of get it in a way, Rob. Like the main product that cable news sells is outrage. Like it exists to make people mad. And so, this is a local organization. I was like, maybe we don't want to like make people mad all the time.
Well, what do you go to a gym for, Rob? You're trying to get your heart rate up.
That's a good point. This is a good point. The best part was the guy in the a source in the story, the Stevens Point Journal story on this, said that he couldn't watch his cable news. He had to resort to watching soccer.
I don't know. I wouldn't complain about that myself. And then you're inspired by these really fit people. I don't know. Well, Rob, before we get done, I want to mention it's Rob's big break. Not me, Rob. You, Rob. Next Thursday, you're going to be hosting one of WPR's regional shows, Route 51, right, Airing in the Wausau area. What's on the docket?
Yeah, no, I'm excited about this. A little guest host. Yeah, we're going to talk about the outrageous story of the Rhinelander Hodag, which has turned 125 years old this year. And we're going to talk to a local historian from Rhinelander and a reporter who wrote a story on this about the mythical beast. And it's a great, it's sort of origin story. It's going to be great.
I don't want to spoil things here, but are you going to have a real live Hodag in the studio with you?
We have some audio. We have some audio. It's contested. We'll see. People can make up their own minds.
All right. One legend, Robert Mentzer, talking about another legend, the Hodag. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Rob Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us every week for a look at some of the top stories in the news happening around Wisconsin.
If you've noticed some products hitting the stores with packaging and labels that might include a marijuana leaf, you might be wondering, isn't that illegal?
While marijuana itself remains illegal here in the state, CBD, a compound that's found in both the hemp and marijuana plants, is a gray area. It's likely that someone you know might have tried it for some variety of reasons, for health reasons, maybe even on their dog.
Dan Nasowitz is a freelance writer and editor for publications including Atlas Obscura, New York Magazine, and more. He wrote the piece, CBD is Everywhere, but Is It a Scam?, for Vox.com to help us sort through all the information that's out there. I spoke with Dan on Wednesday, and with the passing of the Farm Bill, hemp is now legalized. While this doesn't directly affect the legality of CBD, it can be extracted from the hemp plant, and we can see more of it in the future. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the basics. First, what is CBD and where does it come from?
So CBD is short for cannabidiol. It's one of the many chemical compounds that's present in the cannabis plant. There's this kind of large group of them called cannabinoids. We don't know how many there are, even. About 100 have been discovered. There's definitely more. We don't know how many. It's probably one of the most lucrative of the cannabinoids, the other one being THC.
A lot of people hear CBD and they associate it with marijuana, but CBD does not give a person the high that marijuana does, correct?
That's correct, yeah. CBD is not psychoactive in the way that we normally think about it. It's present in what's called industrial hemp, which is just a different strain of the cannabis plant that's grown to have very little THC in it.
Now, we're seeing all sorts of different products infused with CBD or created with CBD oil, including one Madison brewery that just launched a CBD-infused beer. Can you give us a sense of what other kind of products we're seeing on the market?
Oh, there's tons. There's no limit to them. You'll see topical oils and creams and lotions. You'll see vapes. Those are really common. You'll see oils that are supposed to be added to foods. You'll see gummies. There's really no limit to the different ways that you'll see it sold.
Why have we seen the market grow so much and so suddenly?
So there's a couple of reasons for that. One of them being that cannabis is sort of in the process of being legalized in various forms. It's kind of stuttering and stalting, but it definitely is becoming more legal. The other thing is kind of a general trend for what used to be called homeopathic drugs, now sort of natural remedies or alternative medicines. It definitely falls under that kind of broad category. And there's also kind of a general preference now or kind of a new trend for plant-based solutions to medical issues or whatever problems people kind of want to solve.
You mentioned homeopathic methods. Is that the motivating factor as to why people are going out and buying CBD products?
Sometimes people kind of buy it the same way that they buy a coffee or a tea. They just kind of want something that's thought to have a very slight kind of physical effect.
Now, CBD is federally illegal, but that hasn't stopped the market. Can you explain the legality of the product and how it's still so readily available?
Yeah, that's kind of a complicated question, and it's actually about to change because the Senate just passed the 2018 Farm Bill, which CBD and hemp is kind of a big deal in. So it's kind of tricky because this is a bunch of different departments within the government kind of arguing amongst themselves about whether it's legal or not. The DEA maintains that any product derived from cannabis in any form is federally illegal. It's the same schedule as cocaine. They consider it a very bad thing, but they don't really go after anyone who's growing industrial hemp for CBD. They're not really going after anyone who's selling CBD. So you can pretty much buy it in all 50 states. There was in the 2014 Farm Bill, which is the previous one, there was a provision for some pilot projects to grow industrial hemp in various states. And those have kind of made a foothold in getting CBD grown in the U.S. kind of more accepted. And the 2018 Farm Bill, if it passes, which it probably will, is a major step forward in that it makes CBD and industrial hemp federally legal, can be grown in all 50 states. It has some weird restrictions on it that makes it sort of unlike other crops. For example, one of the provisions is a 10-year ban. So any state or federal drug felon, so anyone who has a felony on their record for a drug-related crime, can't participate in growing hemp, which is sort of insane because it's not a psychoactive product. It's just a crop like anything else. And obviously there's no law prohibiting a felon from growing corn or wheat or soy or whatever. But there will be a 10-year ban for drug felons growing hemp, which is strange. But otherwise, it's going to be basically the same as other crops now.
We're talking with Dan Nasiewicz, a freelance writer and editor for publications including Atlas Obscura, New York Magazine, and more. He wrote the piece, CBD is Everywhere, but Is It a Scam, for Vox.com. So, Dan, we've got people buying CBD for all kinds of reasons, but how much do we know, if anything, about its proven effects?
So very little. The problem here is that a product kind of has to be legal in order to really get a lot of research behind it. It's just been very difficult while cannabis was federally illegal for scientists to kind of amass the large scale amount of research and testing and clinical trials and all that stuff that you need to really understand a product. So it's super limited. We really know very little about, say, drug-drug interactions. We know basically nothing about that. We know very little about how CBD really affects the brain, which specific sensors it's triggering. We don't really know. We don't know dosage. That's like a major issue, that we don't know how much you should take or in what form. We don't know whether you should take this much in a vape, this much in an oil, this much in a gummy. It's very, very unclear. The research is super limited. There's basically no research into the kind of small dosage that you'll see in CBD additives. Most of it's being done for stuff like epilepsy and like large anxiety projects, stuff like that.
Yeah, you also wrote in your piece that just in along the lines of what you just said about researchers and professionals that are in the field are skeptical about CBD products. Is that where the attitude is coming from, that we really don't know what the real benefits or effects of CBD is?
Yeah, I think it comes from two places. One of them is definitely just a lack of research, that there's so little that we really know about how CBD works. The other element is that it's so unregulated at the moment that it can be kind of anything. And a lot of the researchers that I talk to just don't trust the products that you would be buying online or in a store. There's been very little oversight from the USDA or the FDA about what's actually in this stuff, whether it does the things that it claims. And there was actually, of the very, very few times that anyone in the government has actually tested these products, they found that some of them, you know, these are isolates. So they're supposed to be 99 or 100% just pure CBD. Some of them had no CBD in them at all. Some of them had high levels of THC, which, aside from being illegal, is sort of dangerous, because if you're taking this to kind of calm down and then you get in your car and you start, you know, you drive to work before a big meeting, you might have a substantial amount of THC in there, which is dangerous. A lot of the researchers are very, very, very skeptical about the stuff that you can buy.
Now, a big part of your piece that you wrote for Vox was sorting through all the information and claims that are out there about CBD to try to find out all the important pieces. So I'm wondering, after all the research that you've done, what do you think? Is it a hoax or a scam, or is it a passing trend?
Got all of the above and none of the above at the same time. It's really interesting because it's not nonsense. CBD is not like complete nonsense. Like,
sure,
you know, crystals are nonsense. Like a Himalayan salt lamp is nonsense. It's not real. It doesn't do anything. CBD is not that. It actually is an interesting chemical compound that has these interesting properties. It was actually approved for an epilepsy drug. It's proven to be a really promising treatment for schizophrenia. It does have these kind of anti-inflammatory and anti-anxiety effects, but that doesn't mean that the stuff you're buying in the store like does any of that. A lot of it is just way, like, orders of magnitude too low of a dose, partly because to have the right dose would be like kind of a lot of oil and would be really expensive and taste really bad. We don't know what's in it. We don't know how it works. Like, it's a really promising thing, but the level of hype and misinformation and the total lack of trust that experts have in the products on the market. I think people should kind of read a lot about it and maybe stay away until it's figured out exactly how this stuff works.
And finally, Dan, let's say somebody that's listening right now has been wanting to give CBD a try. What should they keep in mind when buying a product or deciding to try something the local coffee shop is selling?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, try it. Like, it's not likely to be that dangerous. It's CBD itself is there hasn't really been much in terms of like dangerous side effects that have been in there. I don't know. I mean, I think you can try it fairly safely. I think I would read a lot about it and try to read actual scientific studies rather than blog posts and that kind of thing, because everyone, there's a ton of money involved in this and a lot of people are trying to sell you stuff. I wouldn't trust that. I don't know. It's a really complicated thing. I think you can try it fairly safely. But I wouldn't necessarily have a ton of faith that your CBD coffee is going to be doing anything.
Dan, thanks so much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Dan Nosiewicz, freelance writer and editor for publications including Atlas Obscura, New York Magazine, and more. He wrote the piece, CBD is Everywhere, but Is It a Scam? For Vox.com.
For a lot of people, dealing with the IRS may not exactly be a pleasant experience.
There are complicated rules to follow, long wait times if you want help sorting through them, and of course, for some, the part where you hand over a chunk of your money.
It's also no secret that many Republican lawmakers share that distaste for the IRS. Here's Republican Senator Ted Cruz gearing up for his presidential run in Iowa 3 years ago with a line that he said was only partially tongue-in-cheek.
We should abolish the IRS. There are about 90,000 employees at the IRS. We need to padlock that building. Take all 90,000 and put them down on our southern border.
But in a new piece, our next guest details just how far lawmakers have gone to make cuts to the agency over the last few decades and some of the consequences of that effort.
Jesse Eisinger is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. He's a senior reporter and editor at ProPublica. He co-reported the recent piece titled How the IRS Was Gutted. Jesse, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I think for a lot of people this may be under the radar, but you report extensive cuts in funding and staffing at the IRS over the last couple of decades. Can you talk about what has changed?
Sure. Well, you know, this is a mass cut. Thousands of employees have left, billions of dollars in budget cuts, but it's all been in kind of death by a thousand cuts, small incremental cuts over the years since 2011 after the Republicans took over the Congress and the Tea Party revolt. And so people really haven't focused on it, and they haven't really understood the consequences. And the consequences are really stark. This is a bureaucracy on life support now.
Yeah, let's look at those consequences, things we think of as the basic mission of the IRS, not even getting to audits, we'll get into that, but the most basic thing, the IRS saying, hey, somebody was supposed to file their taxes, and they didn't. They didn't even file. They're investigating that kind of basic case way less than they used to?
Yeah, so they used to do it. They used to chase down millions of people who didn't even file their taxes. In 2011, they did about 2.5 million of those. Last year, they did 362,000. So a huge drop in just that kind of thing. Another thing they did was, so tax debt expires if you've most tax debt if you've sort of filed and they've asked you to pay. After 10 years, if they haven't collected from you, it expires. And in 2010, they had a very little bit of money, $482 million of tax debt lapsing. Last year, 2017, it was $8.3 billion, 17 times as much. They just don't have the ability to chase down these very basic things anymore because of the severe budget cuts and headcount reduction.
And then there's the audits, and you have a very striking chart showing who's being audited and how it's changing over the years. And one of the big stories, if I'm looking at this chart right, the number of wealthy people being audited really has taken a sharp downturn in the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, so, you know, everybody's rejoicing now and jumping up in the air about how glorious this is should understand that the big beneficiaries of this are the wealthy and the largest corporations in America. And study after study has shown that the wealthy cheat on their taxes much more than the poor, because most of us have W-2s and our taxes get withheld in our paychecks, and it's very hard to cheat when you have that kind of situation. Wealthy people have partnerships, LLCs, offshore operations, et cetera, so they can cheat. So, but the audits of the wealthy have collapsed. Now, wealthy people are still audited at higher rates than the super wealthy are audited at higher rates than average people, but those audit rates are way, way down. Now, the top 1% have gone from an 8% audit rate to 2.5% audit rate. So, you know, a collapse of 75%. But the audit rate of the poor has not gone down as much. And in fact, today, the IRS audits the working poor, people who get earned income tax credit, working poor, more than they do affluent people who make $200,000. So if you asked your listeners yesterday, who gets audited more, someone who makes $20,000 or someone who makes $400,000, the answer turns out to be the person making $20,000.
And that's something that Congress required, right, to give, I guess, oversight for the earned income tax credit?
So this is exactly. So this is basically a project of the Republicans, and it has been really since the 1990s when the Newt Gingrich Contract with America came in. They took a run at really kind of reforming / gutting the IRS. Then the IRS recovered, and then in 2011 the Republicans came back into power, and they really have started attacking the IRS and chipping away at the budget and cutting off their powers. But the one thing that they did was they really focus on the EITC and money going out of the government to the working poor, you know, people who have jobs but their jobs don't quite make enough, and they get a benefit, and they get a benefit of a couple thousand dollars a year. This is not like huge amounts, life changing money. They're not driving Rolls Royces, but the Republicans have really made them audit these people so much, and in fact have restricted the payments on this. So they made it actually the crackdown harder in 2015. So now people are really waiting and waiting for months and months for their credits. When they've become dependent on them, they really need them to live and get by.
And you talked to former IRS officials, workers there, who said there's a priority since they have fewer people to work with. They kind of go for the low-hanging fruit, the cases that they can resolve quickly. So if I lie and say I made half as much money last year as I actually did, that's an easy case. If I hide a lot of money in the Cayman Islands and Cyprus and do these really complicated things, that's going to take a long time to sort out. They may not have the time, the person power, or the expertise to challenge that.
Yeah, exactly. So a couple things are going on here. One is, some people have said, well, you know, it doesn't matter that they have so many fewer auditors because computers can take care of this, right? And in fact, that's not the case. What it is true is that automated returns and automated audits can happen for the poor or for average people who send in their W-2s, like I was talking about earlier. But the wealthy and even the affluent have much more complicated returns, and for that it takes auditors really looking at it, people who are well-trained. Well, the people who have left are often the people who have the ability to get other jobs in the private sector. And so the skill set has dropped dramatically. Now, the number of auditors at the IRS today is under 10,000 people. And the last time it was under 10,000 people was in 1953, the year that Joseph Stalin died. Eisenhower was president. The economy was a seventh of the size it is today. And those auditors have less skills, fewer skills than they used to. And what that means is the wealthy in corporations are getting away with paying a lot less tax and becoming much more aggressive.
We're talking to Jesse Eisinger of ProPublica about his reporting on cuts to the IRS that have taken place over the last few decades.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this? Are you concerned about the IRS not being able to carry out some of its basic functions? As a voter, would you be willing to support someone who wanted to restore funding to the IRS in the hopes of fixing this? Or do you think the agency should have to make do with less? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
We continue our conversation about an effort to roll back the size and scope of the IRS. Jesse Eisinger is with us from ProPublica.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about cuts at the IRS and their ability to perform some of their basic functions? Is this something you'd like to see changed, turned around? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. To your calls now, John is with us in Green Bay. John, hi.
Hi. So I used to be a tax preparer, and when I did taxes, we used to see a lot of the earned income credit applications come through. We used to see a lot of people that would bring in reported income right underneath that earned income credit limit, so they'd really maximize their refund. Now, the refund would be refundable, meaning that they would actually get money back much greater than what they paid in, sometimes 50% of their total income. And from the reading and things that I've seen, it's something that's really taken advantage of illegally. I'd just like to kind of get your thoughts on that.
John, thanks for the call. Jesse, maybe John's saying there is a reason to scrutinize those earned income tax credit claims more closely.
Well, I appreciate his anecdotal evidence. But, you know, first of all, we're talking about very small sums of money. But the study after study, academic studies show that actually the wealthy, who obviously have more money and have more at stake, also evade taxes more. So one of the things that the IRS has been looking at is people who have offshore bank accounts in places like Switzerland or other tax havens, Singapore or the Bahamas, and then they have often millions of dollars that they're not reporting to the IRS. So when you look at where the money is, it's really in corporations that take tax avoidance strategies that are incredibly aggressive, and then employ big-time accountants and law firms to fight the IRS, and the super wealthy. Your income tax credit may have some fraud. I'm sure that that's true. A lot of the fraud, though, actually is in tax preparers who, and this is something that the IRS has studied and found, tax preparers who take advantage of the poor and then get refunds and then charge a lot of money on the refund. So it is an area of fraud, but there's more fraud among the tax preparers who help people with the EITC than it is from the actual people who are filing the EITC.
John, thanks for calling in. Jesse, you heard from John Koskinen, a former, I think, director of the IRS. He's warned that we risk having this crisis situation like has been seen in Greece or Italy, where if people start to know that they're probably not going to be audited, they might not get caught if they don't even file at all, that could lead to kind of a viral phenomenon of people avoiding taxes.
Exactly, and he's not the only one. Actually, the IRS commissioners since the last George W. Bush appointee have been warning about the budget cuts and this problem. I mean, we're not Greece and Italy yet. That would be hyperbolic. But there's something called the tax gap, and it's the amount of money that the IRS estimates that people are basically avoiding or cheating on their taxes. So what the IRS estimates is that people are pay about, collectively, about 82% of the money that they owe. And the problem is that the last study was done in 2016, and the last study actually didn't study 2016. It studied the years 2008 to 2010.
to get to a number of about $450 billion, which would be about $660 billion if the rate were the same today. But we just don't know. We just don't know. And if it were one percentage point higher, we're talking about tens of billions of dollars more that the U.S. government is not collecting, basically because the IRS just doesn't have the ability to go get it. So we are very vulnerable to huge amounts of money, giant amounts of money that the IRS can't collect simply because we are not fully funding the IRS. And the thing to really understand about the IRS is that it's an incredibly efficient operation. So every dollar that the IRS spends brings in many more dollars to the U.S. government, about $4 or $5 to the U.S. government for every dollar it spends, and about $10 for every enforcement dollar. So this is hardly a wasteful bureaucracy.
And you write that the problem here may be disguised because we're going through a recovery from that great recession in that time period you were just talking about. So tax revenues are going up because the economy is improving. If the economy starts to go down, we might suddenly start to feel the hit if we're not if we're missing this huge percentage of taxes.
Yeah, so tax receipts are going up, the raw numbers, and so that does mask things, as you just said. But as a percentage of GDP, as a percentage of the size of the economy, tax receipts are down, lower than they were in the mid-2000s, lower than they were in the 1990s. So we clearly have a collection problem, but the long recovery since the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009 is masking the real problem here.
And briefly, as we wrap up, are there any policymakers, people in Congress, who are raising this as a concern?
Quietly, they are. The Republicans have, you know, so there were some Hill staffers that admitted to us, you know, we really were out to punish the IRS, and one of them told us, you know, that was a mistake. What they've realized is, oh, my God, we passed a huge tax overhaul, and the IRS is going to have to implement it. And if the IRS doesn't implement it well, people are going to get really angry and complain. So they have given a little bit more budget for certain things like customer service. But what they haven't done is raise the budget for enforcement. That's still flat to down. So that means audits are down, criminal enforcement of tax is down, collections are down, all the kinds of things that would crack down on tax evaders and tax cheats are still really on life support.
Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter and editor at ProPublica, with us to talk about his recent investigative piece titled How the IRS Was Gutted.
This week, Barron musician Chris Cruzy learned he had been selected as one of the final four competitors on the NBC television program The Voice. His success has gripped the West Central Wisconsin community. Barronites are putting up yard signs and gathering for viewing parties by the hundreds to show their support for the 27-year-old Cruzy.
But in Cruzy's early years, singing was an afterthought. He became obsessed with the guitar after getting one for his sixth birthday, but some fatherly advice got him to supplement his strumming with his vocals.
My dad, I remember, I don't know if he even knows this, but that I remember this, or if he even remembers saying it, but he told me when I was really young, like, he's like, well, if you want to, you know, play guitar for a living someday or be in a band, someone's got to be a singer. And he said, and if you can sing, you know, if you can figure out that you can sing, he said, you might as well be the singer too. So I sang a lot, closed door in my bedroom, singing quietly and figuring out how to do that. In eighth grade rolled around and they were having a school talent show. And I'd played guitar in school talent shows previous to that. So I was like, well, what can I do that's different? I mulled it over in my brain a lot and I decided to sing, but I didn't tell anybody that I was going to. So I didn't tell my mom or my dad. They showed up to the talent show thinking, oh, Chris is going to play guitar again. I got up there and my mom said she watched me walk up to a microphone and she said her stomach just dropped. She was so nervous. She never heard me sing. Yeah, and I sang a song called Only God Knows Why by Kid Rock. Really good reception from it. Everybody liked it and encouraged me to keep going. So then that was when I kind of honed in on starting singing, you know.
For most of the past decade, Cruzy has been a popular performer at events and parties in West Central Wisconsin, and he's also made some overseas trips to entertain U.S. troops in the Middle East.
When Cruzy got the news that he was selected from 40,000 entrants to compete on The Voice, the decision for the father of two young children wasn't automatic.
I'm super lucky that I've got an understanding wife who is on board with all of this. When the opportunity came for me to do The Voice, my wife and I had a conversation. Basically, it started out by me saying, you know, I got an email. They're inviting me out to be a contestant on The Voice this year. And she said, well, that's exciting. I said, yeah, and it means I'm going to be gone all summer and pretty much all fall. And so she said, well, if we think it's the right thing to do. And I said, but if you're not on board, then I'm not on board. Because, I mean, I've said this a bunch, and it probably sounds cliche, but it's absolutely true. Music is my career. It's my passion and everything. But if it comes down to making a choice between music and my family wins every time.
On his first appearance on The Voice, Cruzy elected to be on the team captained by country legend Blake Shelton. He has continued to advance in the competition through streaming of his music and voting by people throughout the country, but especially in Wisconsin.
Cruzy says the coaching he received as part of the show has added new layers to his skills.
I think the biggest areas that I've grown in is, like, truly entertaining. You know, I've been playing music full-time for pretty much almost 7 years, 200 to 250 shows a year. Most of those shows are me and acoustic guitar. You know, what we're doing out here is very different than that. You know, it's a big part of it is engaging the crowd and showing that you're having fun. You know, just getting more comfortable on stage and just kind of letting loose and doing your thing and letting that come through. And people seem to like it. I've honestly never really been a true entertainer until I came out here.
Cruzy performs for the final time on The Voice Monday night and will learn if he wins Tuesday night. But Cruzy says the experience has already been a win for him and the other three finalists.
It honestly doesn't really feel like a competition. We've been living in a hotel with everybody for, you know, the better part of 6 months. And yeah. So we know everybody well. And, you know, if someone's struggling with their song, people step in and help, and other contestants help out and figure out different stuff that they can try to make it better. And it's definitely a competition, but it's not a nasty competition. Everybody's playing to win. But I think, I mean, most of us out here at this point realize that if I go home, it's not the end of the world. There's no bad outcome at this point. So I don't know. I mean, we're pushing, doing everything we can, but if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen.
Chris Cruzy of Barron talked this week with Al Ross, host of WPR's Eau Claire-based regional program Spectrum West. You can listen to the full interview at WPR.org, click on shows, and then on Spectrum West, and you can read an article, including some additional content, over at WPR.org.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, why are we so angry? Our guest digs into anger in American politics to find the roots of extreme polarization and some possible solutions.
Family ties sometimes come untied. Our guest shares her personal story of estrangement with a family member and why it can be such a difficult problem to deal with.
And we'll meet the Wisconsin creator of a new documentary about the consequences of medical errors.
That and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.